This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday, the Panthers won, but Charlotte might have lost. We're going to talk about the bombshell announcement that Jerry Richardson plans to sell the team. We'll hear about that first, and then meet Mecklenburg County's new district attorney. The man who brought the NFL to the Carolinas has been accused of misconduct in the workplace, and some of those accusations have now been detailed in a sweeping article in Sports Illustrated. Prior to the publishing of that article, the Panthers announced an investigation led by Erskine Bowles and one of the nation's largest law firms. That didn't sit well with some others in the league, so over the weekend, the NFL announced they were taking over the investigation. But shortly after the Panthers' win yesterday afternoon over Green Bay, Jerry Richardson released a statement announcing that it was time to turn the franchise over to new ownership. Therefore, he said, I will put the team up for sale at the conclusion of this NFL season. This could have major ramifications, not just for football fans, but for the city of Charlotte. The Panthers are homegrown and have become one of the most valuable franchises in the league. Buying the team will take deep pockets, perhaps deeper than anyone in this region can afford. Could this ultimately mean a move for the team? We're joined by Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, who's just rapidly typing on his phone, already writing articles about this. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you.
And NBC's Darren Gantt is with us. He is a Charlotte-based reporter for the network's Pro Football Talk website, Pro Football Talk. Darren, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Is this announcement of a postseason sale of the Panthers by Jerry Richardson his answer, do you think, to these allegations? I think, Darren, you've met him, right?
Yeah, I've dealt with him for a long time, working at the newspaper for over 14 years, covering that team on a day-to-day basis, had a lot of interactions with him. And it's alarming, and Eric and I talked about this in the press box yesterday. It's alarming how quickly this thing moved. It went from, boy, what's going to happen? Does this rise to the level of George Shinn effectively being run out of town on a rail to, you know, 4 hours after the game? Oh, yeah, he's selling the team. I mean, this thing's moved at a startling pace. And, you know, I think a lot of people are still trying to process it. But, you know, some of the factors in this case are easy to overlook. I mean, the plan was in place from the time he fired his sons in 2009 to sell the team within 2 years of his passing anyway. So there's some degree of wheels in motion on this. He's already been thinking about this for years to come. This just, as with everything, this just sped up the process.
So watching the game yesterday on television, they showed Jerry Richardson sitting in his box with his wife, and some of the commentators obviously talked about these scandals breaking. But if you looked at his inscrutable face, he didn't show any pressure. Do you think he'd made this decision prior to the game, Eric?
I don't know. I mean, the thing with Jerry Richardson, and Darren mentioned it, anyone who's dealt with him, I mean, I've dealt with him a little bit. I'm not going to claim to know him to any degree, but his demeanor never changes. I mean, he always looks like that. I mean, it's kind of a running joke among football fans that he always sort of has that same inscrutable look that you just mentioned. I wanted to go back to what Darren said. When the news first came out that they had hired an internal investigator on Friday night, I started thinking about owners in sports and some of the punishments if violations are found. And I immediately thought of Donald Sterling with the Los Angeles Clippers in 2014, leaked recordings of him making racist comments, and it was pretty quick that the NBA pretty quickly banned him for life, but it still took a couple of months before the team was sold. The league did force him to sell. This is a little bit different in that the NFL did not technically force him to sell, but, I mean, you're talking about 48 hours.
This How do thing, we know?
Well, I mean, the
Well, because on Friday, this right, began yeah. to float around, and it was very unspecific. We just knew that he'd been accused of misconduct in the workplace. That was on Friday, and that we knew that the Panthers decided they would investigate themselves. Erskine Bowles, I believe, is a minority owner of the team. He was going to lead the investigation along with the nation's largest law firm, which is a West Coast law firm whose name escapes me at the moment. Then, on Sunday, the NFL got involved and said, no, we don't like the idea that they're going to investigate themselves. We'll do it. The game is played. No one talks about it. The players leave the stadium. 3 hours later, bang, I'm selling the team.
Well, if he was, if the NFL had forced him to sell, let's assume that he didn't want to sell, then he would have fought back. It wouldn't have all happened in the span of 7 hours. So I think that, that is a voluntary move, don't you, Darren?
Well, and the other thing I would point out, I mean, and a lot of this is frankly kind of moot timeline-wise because this thing is has evolved into a completely different story now. But the attempt to put Erskine Bowles in charge of an internal investigation was damage control. It was, let's put our own guy in. He is a minority shareholder. You know, it's a longtime family relationship in addition to the business relationship. And that was their attempt to get out in front of the story, mm-hmm. To put their spin on it in advance of. I think at a certain point, it wasn't, you know, the Panthers contend that they went to the league after I think they realized the enormity of this thing and said, hey, maybe it's best if you take this over. But the NFL should have been investigating this from the start. They investigated a lot of things a lot less serious and less important than this. So,
Deflategate would be one.
Yeah, I mean, Deflategate. I mean, they do this. You know, the NFL investigates every time someone gets arrested, the Greg Hardy situation. I mean, these things are commonplace for the NFL. So that they were taking over was not a surprise either. Because I don't think trying to put Erskine Bowles in charge of an investigation was ever viewed as anything other than an effort it's been considered.
So on Friday, we were being told that he was being accused of alleged misconduct in the workplace. Did that stem from what has now become the Sports Illustrated story? Who leaked all of that?
Well, sure.
Where did that
they
information
didn't
come from?
They didn't do it on their own. I mean, they knew middle of the week that Sports Illustrated was about to drop the story. And so everything was done in anticipated reaction.
Is this decision to sell? I'm trying to get into the mind of Jerry Richardson with two people who really can't get into his mind because nobody can. But is this a reaction, do you think, on his part, based on anger that these accusations have come out, or a realization that if it's true, this kind of behavior no longer flies and you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Or is it just that he's 81 years old, he's had open-heart surgery, he's a billionaire, he doesn't need this aggravation?
I think there's an element to that, Mike, because one thing about him in recent years, since the heart transplant surgery, he's really taken a step back. He used to be one of the most influential owners in league circles, was part of the compensation committee that sets Roger Goodell's exorbitant salary, was part of the relocation committee, was really a driver in the process of getting the NFL back to Los Angeles. The only problem was he took a terrible beating in that process. He wanted two teams to share a stadium in Carson. New money NFL, kind of spearheaded by Jerry Jones, sort of hijacked that process and resulted in the Rams building their own stadium in Inglewood. And that's a long way of saying his influence in the league wasn't what it used to be. He had resigned from all the committees he had previously been seated on, given up a lot of the control, stopped going to league meetings, had been sending Tina Becker, who is effectively his number two here, in the wake of Danny Morrison leaving town. Tina had been representing him at league meetings for the last couple of years. So he had taken a big step back already. And again, I think because of his age, because of his health, because of the pre-existing condition of I'm going to sell this team shortly after I'm gone, this seemed almost like a natural extension. I mean, as crazy as it sounds to say an NFL owner decided to sell his team overnight, I think once this came out, I think in this climate, a lot of people felt like it was inevitable, so he went ahead and did it.
Sports Illustrated did this article, and it's a sweeping article, and we'll talk about some of the accusations that are floated in this article in a second. But what led them, do you think, to write this article? Is this the first shoe to drop? Did they have some heads up on this? Did women come forward because they're coming forward everywhere?
I mean, we could only guess and speculate, but my hunch would be that people went, either the reporters knew some of the people who had made settlements, or the people who made settlements went to the reporters, and then the story progressed from there. That would just be my guess.
In short, Sports Illustrated writes, we have learned that at least four former Panthers employees have received significant monetary settlements due to inappropriate workplace comments and conduct by owner Jerry Richardson, including sexually suggestive language and behavior, and on at least one occasion directing a racial slur at an African-American Panthers scout. And the settlements came with non-disclosure requirements. So if these people have come forward, are they going to have to give the money back?
That's a good question. I was going to say, that's probably your next guest could answer that much better than I could.
Yeah, you need someone from the legal department on that one to go through the law of confidential settlements. But, yeah, I mean, there was obviously some reporting going on weeks in advance on this one. You did have some disgruntled former employees, and there were some folks who talked in specific, terms about things they saw and things they were exposed to during that time. So, as quickly as this story came together, I mean, this is something based, I'm talking to some people in the business. Sports Illustrated has been working on this for some time. This has been weeks in the making, which is only appropriate when you're dealing with something of this magnitude, and it's natural. I mean, we're in the middle of a Me Too movement. People who speak about sexual harassment, workplace environments, were just named Time's Person of the Year. I mean, this is in the national consciousness, from Harvey Weinstein to the halls of Congress and beyond. So I think it was only natural that the NFL was going to be on the target list of such investigations. And frankly, I think a lot of people in the NFL are kind of breathing a sigh of relief this morning, because it's here and not in their precinct.
One of the things that has been widely reported as a result of this article is some of the comments that Jerry Richardson is alleged to have made, like, show me how you wiggle to get those jeans up. I bet you had to lay down on your bed to fit into those jeans. Did you step into those jeans, or did you have to jump into them? This is on Jeans Day, which the Panthers evidently do on a regular basis. And a lot of employees, one employee was quoted as saying it was viewed as more of a creepy old man thing than as a threat. And another employee says, looking back, he was gaining our trust before doing things he shouldn't be doing. He volunteered to shave one woman's legs for her. This is a different generation. He's 81. I'm not excusing this behavior or any of the comments, but it's a different time. Does that matter?
No, it doesn't matter. I think that the country has spoken pretty clearly in the past 2 months or whatever it's been since the Harvey Weinstein report. I think that the mood of the country is very clear right now. Maybe it shifts in the future, but I'd say at this moment, just this is emblematic of what's going on.
This is contemporary. So if these things had happened in the 1950s or the 1960s, and women were coming forward about this now, about his behavior then, would it be different? Because it was a different time and with different sensibilities, and things were different. Things that were acceptable then are no longer acceptable now. Or is this different because this is now? It's contemporary.
That's a hard thing to answer. I think that being contemporary has more weight. I would put it that way. But I just think we're in such a highly charged moment right now that people are looking at this and just saying no more.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yesterday, before he decided to sell the team and before the Sports Illustrated article came out, quarterback Cam Newton was asked about his contacts with Jerry Richardson.
For me, I hope things doesn't, alter my thinking of Mr. Richardson. But for what I do know, man, he's given, me some things that, I just will forever be appreciative for him.
And Ron Rivera had this to say.
I told the guys I have a lot of information out there. I don't know what's been written and what's been said. All I know is what Mr. Richardson has been for me, and it's been very supportive.
The story has since evolved. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Cameron McIntosh's new production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera, January 17th through 28th at Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And Taylor Richards and Conger, a specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories. Phillips Place, next to Dean and DeLuca. Details at trcstyle.com. We're going to take a look back tomorrow on a whirlwind year in politics, from Washington to Charlotte, from President Trump's inaugural address to the string of controversies that followed, from the attempt to repeal Obamacare to the new tax plan. In Raleigh, our new Democratic governor has been repeatedly at odds with the Republican legislature, and here in Charlotte, the incumbent mayor voted out. We'll dive deeper into all of those political goings-on with our panel of experts tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Gelton. Coming up on the next On Point, the FBI and the Russia investigation, anti-Trump text messages between two former FBI officials are raising concerns over bias in the agency. We'll dig in. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the shocking announcement yesterday evening that Jerry Richardson is now going to sell the Panthers or put it on the market as soon as the season is over, as soon as they play in the Super Bowl, essentially. We're talking about this with Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer with the Charlotte Business Journal, and Darren Gant, reporter for NBC Sports, Pro Football Talk. This has major ramifications for this city because if this team leaves, we played that piece of tape from Cam Newton saying he looked up to Mr. Richardson. He also said that Richardson had played a father-like role in his life. But there's a report in the Sports Illustrated article, Darren, that he also made several inappropriate racial comments. Among them, he is alleged to have said to Cam Newton after he signed him, between the signing him and playing his first game, I hope that in the interim you haven't gone off and gotten a lot of piercing and tattoos. Is that racial? Is that inappropriate? It's his team. He has an image that he wants his players to uphold. Is that wrong?
Right. And I think it's important to note, Mike, that was an interview conducted with Charlie Rose, whose legacy is certainly different now than when that interview took place. I mean, I think it's an indicator of the overall worldview. I think one of the things you got to remember is people process through this, and I don't say this in any way, shape, or form to excuse what he's been accused of doing. He is a product of a different time and a different place. I mean, being an 81-year-old white man who grew up and made himself Southern gentry, he has a different mindset than the people he's around now. So the notion of a tattooed quarterback is something that never occurred to him. This man played with Johnny Unitas. That's what, in his mind, quarterbacks looked like. So when Cam Newton fell into his lap in 2011, I think he was forced into a quick realization that times have changed. And I think that's probably, as much as anything, what I take away from this entire story is that the world changed around Jerry Richardson, and he never caught up with it. Yeah. I mean, the things that he always assumed as a captain of industry to be a normal part of business simply aren't acceptable, simply aren't normal, simply aren't, you know, the things we can accept anymore.
So let's talk about the money. I interviewed Mr. Richardson several years ago in a public forum in which he talked about never asking the city of Charlotte for a dime to build that stadium. The city of Charlotte.
Whoops.
The city of Charlotte came forward and offered money to them for the upgrade. He never asked for it.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I'm just telling you what he said.
Okay.
He never asked for it.
No, but
he said,
there might have been leaks that the team might be sold and moved to California, but he never asked for any money.
Let me tell you my apocryphal story here, please.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He said that Charlotte needed to start thinking about ways to keep the team, that there was going to be a need in the next several years for a new stadium. He said, when I die, the team will be sold within 2 years. It's in my will. And he says this team is worth billions of dollars. It's going to require a billionaire to step forward. It's not going to be bought by a consortium of little people throwing $1 million in here and $1 million there. And he said Charlotte does not have any billionaires in their back pocket. So it's probably going to be bought by somebody out of town. And he went on to say he was the chairman of the NFL committee on where teams are.
Stadiums, right.
Stadiums. Yeah. He said, I've done everything in my power to make sure this team cannot move. But he said, you know, money talks. Money talks. So let's talk about this, because this would be a tragic blow for this city should this team move. If it's true that only a billionaire could buy this team, why would the billionaire want to keep it here?
Well, several questions there. First of all, why would it be tragic? I mean, we lost an NBA team, and the NBA was back in 2 years. I'm not saying that people want the Panthers to go away, but teams move. So I think that if you're negotiating this...
I'm talking about the economic ramifications of their moving are what?
I mean, sports economists say that it's negligible unless they're working for a team that, you know... Now, again, I'm not saying that anyone wants the Panthers to leave. Let's start with a couple things. First of all, the Panthers are worth $2.3 billion, according to Forbes. Jerry Richardson's group paid $200 million, give or take, in 1993. This team has sold out every home game it's played except two. I think it's a very difficult argument to make to say that the Panthers are in a weak market or a market where they're not financially healthy. So you have to have 24 of 32 owners to approve a sale, and you also have to have league approval to relocate franchise. It doesn't mean it's impossible.
How much is the team worth?
$2.3 billion.
Is that something that Sean P. Diddy Combs could afford?
I would have to speak with his accountant. I mean,
the reason
I
ask is because he's come forward in a tweet and he has said, "I'll buy the team," and here he is.
Well, I need to send a message out to everybody in the beautiful state of North Carolina. I will be the best NFL owner that you can imagine. I will immediately address the Colin Kaepernick situation and put him in the running for next year's starting quarterback. It's just competition, baby. It's just competition. But also, I will have the best halftime show, the best selection of music, and we will win Super Bowl after Super Bowl.
Wait a minute. That sounds just like Donald Trump. So now, and Steph Curry immediately shot back, "I'm in."
Yeah.
So is this a possibility there?
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know that Sean Combs has the liquidity to pull this kind of deal off. I think he's mostly succeeded in getting us to talk about Sean Combs on the radio. I think one of the things people in Charlotte need to be mindful of, you're going to hear a lot of names over the next couple of weeks. You're going to hear Bruton Smith's name get dredged back up. He's been involved in talks about stuff like this for years, and I think he does it just to taunt Jerry Richardson as much as anything because there's a little local rivalry. But the reality of the situation is I don't think the Carolina Panthers are going anywhere. If you were starting a football league from scratch in the United States, and you were going to have 32 teams, Charlotte is one of the places you would put one of them.
Right, because of the television market size. And
there's plenty of money here.
Right, television market size, the population's growing, particularly the millennial growth. I think all those things. I think Charlotte, which suffers from a very severe case of inferiority complex, when something like this happens, everybody immediately says, well, oh, my God, what if the team left? Charlotte is moving into a category where it is one of the 30 or 32 where you would put a team. I think Darren's absolutely right.
Yeah, Charlotte panics. Just look at what happens when Brad Panovich predicts snow for us. But I think realistically and beyond that, I think if you look at a little quick context, the last team to sell was the Buffalo Bills in 2014. Terry and Kim Pegula paid $1.4 billion for the Buffalo Bills, who haven't been to the playoffs in 20 years, who play in one of the worst stadiums in the National Football League.
In the snow.
In one of the least desirable geographic locations in America, and that one was worth $1.4 billion, and they had people lined up around the block to buy it. So I don't think there's going to be any shortage of suitors, and I don't think there's going to be any shortage of people who want to buy it with designs to keep the team here.
Well, on a normal day, we would have had you in, Eric, to talk about the Campbell Soup deal to buy Snyder Lance here in Charlotte, because that has ramifications too. But
that's just a little $5 billion deal.
We'll have to leave it at that. Darren Gant joined us by phone. He's a reporter for NBC Sports. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. We'll have to see where this goes from here. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike.
You know, 2017 is, these are famous last words. 2017 has been a year of change. I wrote that before we knew about Jerry Richardson. But a new president in Washington, a new governor in Raleigh, a new mayor in Charlotte, along with those changes has come an unanticipated one. Former Mecklenburg County District Attorney Andrew Murray was appointed to be U.S. Attorney for the western part of North Carolina, a Republican. Murray recommended Democrat Spencer Merriweather take his place. Mr. Merriweather was sworn in late last month as the first African-American to hold the position in the county's history, and he comes into office at a time when trust trust in law enforcement and community relations are strained. Restoring trust and bettering relations is one of the things he plans to work on. And in the short time he's been in office, he's already begun making changes. We're going to talk about that and more this hour with our new district attorney, Spencer Merriweather. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
I apologize for the truncated nature of this get-to-know-you conversation.
Mike, I'm from the state of Alabama. I'm the last person to be surprised by the news stories being consumed by football.
Why?
Let me just tell you that the state of Alabama is all about football. Like I said, it doesn't surprise me at all.
I should talk about the legal ramifications of all of this, but I won't.
No, you shouldn't, as a matter of fact. So thank you. Yeah.
So you're a Democrat. You were appointed by a Democratic governor to fill the unexpired term of your predecessor, a Republican, who went on to be another job, a Western U.S. Senator, the U.S. Attorney for Western Carolina. Which carried more weight, Murray's recommendation or the fact that you and the governor are in the same party?
I think that my record got out. Both Andrew Murray knows my record. Mm-hmm. Governor Cooper had an opportunity to learn about my record. I got into this work because I wanted to add something to the community to fight for victims. I've done that for almost 11 years now. And I think that was clear to Andrew Murray, clear to Governor Cooper. We've gone from there.
So he's a Republican. You're a Democrat. He's white. You're black. He recommended you. How will your tenure in office be different? How will your focus on what you think is important be different?
It's a strange thing to all of a sudden take this seat to make the jump from assistant district attorney into the job of district attorney. And the first thing you do is take a hard look at your office and what your challenges are. And the first thing that I see is that the role of prosecutor and the role of the DA's office has to evolve. Our immediate challenge is a trust deficit throughout our community. And quite honestly, trust deficits don't make our community safe. So the first thing that I have to do is to make sure that people understand that this is a system. This is an office that works for them. This is an office that belongs to them.
But you're a prosecutor. Why aren't you an adversary to them?
To the community, there is no explanation at all that would substantiate a prosecutor being an adversary to the community. I fight for the community every single day. When I worked with people in treatment court, when I was a drug prosecutor, I was fighting for the community.
But this gets back to the trust question, because there is a significant part of the community, specifically the minority community, who doesn't trust law enforcement. They don't trust the police. They don't think they get a fair shot in the courts. They don't. They think that the sentences they get, that we talked about this last week, about bail and court fines that poor people cannot pay, and so they languish in jail, sometimes for alleged crimes that they didn't commit and crimes that if they had committed and were convicted would serve no jail time. But they're serving jail time prior to trial. So all this adds up to a lack of trust and a lack of distaste and a feeling that they are put upon by the criminal justice system. And you're saying you're their servant. You work for them. How do you convince them of that?
Because when something happens to their kid, they need a prosecutor to fight for them. And when they get robbed and their house gets broken into, they need a prosecutor to fight for them. I have to be of service to people in our community. It's a must. And to the extent that people don't trust me and don't trust prosecutors and don't trust our criminal justice system, we all fail. So I've got an immediate role to fill.
In your career as a prosecutor, you've worked to get justice for homicide victims' families. You were a senior sexual assault prosecutor. You headed up the habitual felon team. You've prosecuted robbers and drug traffickers and others. When you look at these people, those people, the people that you prosecuted,
right,
who actually ended up being guilty of what you prosecuted them for, when you look at them as compared to the general population, have you developed a theory about why those people or how those people came to be criminals versus the rest of the population?
You've just enumerated a lot of different types of crimes,
right,
and there's different answers to all those things. I talk about domestic violence. We talk about people who have decided to exert some level of power and control over someone else. When we talk about people who have been susceptible to drug addiction, you're talking about somebody who's sick, somebody who has been susceptible to an illness. There's a different reason for that. When you talk about someone that's decided to sexually assault someone, there is something different about that. When you talk about someone who, either in the heat of passion or with premeditation and deliberation, has decided to kill someone, there is something different about that. And so there are a lot of different answers to why someone commits a crime.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, at the center of one of the things that I would like to do going forward is, I believe there are, particularly our low-level felonies, drug felonies and property crimes, where I think that people can make a mistake And they should be held accountable for that mistake. But I also think that it's the job of our criminal justice system, and the DA has got a seat at that in restoring people as well.
Is this a shift in belief or focus just in this office, or is this happening around the country? Are you a lone wolf, or are people in criminal justice beginning to take a different look at how things have been done traditionally?
I think evolution more than revolution is probably the key of the day, and I do think it's nationwide. Mm-hmm. And I think I think everyone is responding to the idea that prosecutors aren't there to point the finger at people. We're there to make our communities better. And if it means that someone who's committed an offense needs a hand up, that means that we're making our community better and our community safer. I think everyone across the country is coming to the realization.
You told WBTV News that there's a lot of skepticism about, out in the community about law enforcement and criminal justice. And skepticism, you said, is a good thing, that you got to tell people exactly what you do and how what your values are. So what are those values?
Our values are that we are trying to make the community better and safer. I believe that a safe and vibrant community that is essential to making all people prosper. I believe that we do have to hold people accountable for committing crimes against other people. I also believe that we only give life sentences in certain types of crimes. Mm-hmm. And that means that we have to be open and honest about extending opportunity to people after they have, gone through their sentence of accountability. I believe that we have to be open and honest with members of our community. We have to involve the community and community organizations and community institutions and our criminal justice system and make sure that we're connected to them. Part of the failure of our system right now is that people feel so disconnected from our governmental institutions, particularly the criminal justice system.
When you say life sentences, you're not talking about the judge handing down a life sentence. I'm putting words in your mouth here. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're talking about people who commit a crime when they're young.
Right.
They do the time.
Right.
They get out.
Right.
They can't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
They can't have housing.
Right.
They can't get government help because they have a record.
Right.
That's a life sentence.
That's right.
And you have been working on expungement clinics. There was one, I think, volunteer-staffed expungement clinic, and they saw about, I've forgotten the number now, but a lot of people came forward
right.
for help. And you want to do this on a regular basis.
Now, the district attorney's office has been connected with a number of great organizations that are out there doing wonderful work in our community. There are lines going around the building. And these are laws that have been recently passed by our legislature, where if you've put together 5 or 10 years of law abidingness and it's a low-level nonviolent felony, you can have your record expunged.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have a permanent hand in it. That's a job for government, quite honestly. And I want to make sure that that's permanently accessible to people.
And this affects, I'm told, about 30,000 county residents right now at any given time. They're struggling to find jobs because of these old criminal convictions. When we come back, I want to talk about a little bit more about this and some of the other initiatives that you're putting forth already, even though you've only been in office a couple of weeks now. Evidently, the state of North Carolina does not make it easy to do what you want to do with these expungements, and we'll talk about that. Spencer Merriweather is our guest. He's the new Mecklenburg County District Attorney. We will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com. And CFA Society North Carolina hosting their annual forecast dinner Tuesday, January 9th, providing education and support to North Carolina's investment professionals. Information and registration at cfanorthcarolina.org. The FBI and the Russia investigation. Anti-Trump text messages between FBI officials are raising concerns about bias in the agency. So, On Point, coming up in 20 minutes, guest host Meghna Chakrabarty will talk about that with her panel, and we will continue our conversation with our brand spanking new district attorney, Spencer Merriweather, when we come back. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
A commission on child sex abuse in Australia has completed a landmark 5-year investigation of the problem there.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Mecklenburg District Attorney Spencer Merriweather says the problem requires more attention.
Domestic violence is indeed an epidemic, and what that means.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Spencer Merriweather is our guest in this portion of the program. He's Mecklenburg County's new district attorney, just took over for Andrew Murray, who left to become the U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. We were talking just before the break about your desire to see to it that we can expunge some records of early offenders who've done their time, but having a record prevents them to be from being productive citizens. They kind of have to go back to a life of crime to make money and live in some cases. But evidently, North Carolina does not make it easy to expunge previous offenses. The state limits eligibility to three groups: first-time nonviolent offense committed more than 15 years ago, first-time offense committed between the ages of 18 to 22, or a charge that was dropped or found not guilty at trial that still pops up on records searches. Are those unreasonable restraints to put on?
I believe that the legislature has found that they are, which is why that law has changed effective December 1st, 2017. In fact, for a nonviolent, there is now no limit on the number of dismissed cases that can be expunged. And with regard to nonviolent felonies, that period has been reduced to 10 years. With regard to nonviolent misdemeanors, it has been reduced to 5 years.
This we talked a little bit about how unfairness in the criminal justice system does not make us safer. It makes us less safe. Is this another instance of that? Because if a person can't get a job...
It's not just about jobs. It's also about being able to provide for one's family.
Right.
Being able to provide a family structure. When you have a father or a mother that is has restraints on them because of something they did years and years and years ago, it affects their ability to contribute to the community and contribute to their own family. And so to the extent that the district attorney's office, in connection with a number of other courthouse partners, can make that a little easier, we would love to do that.
You have a lot of things that you want to do. There's some things that you've already begun doing, but you're only here. You're here to fill out the unexpired term of your predecessor, and I believe you'd be up for re-election, which I know you intend to run for.
That's right.
Next year, 2018.
That's right.
So does that put you in an awkward position? Can you do a lot of the things that you want to do, given the fact that you're kind of just filling time?
Well, I'm not just filling time. I promise you, I'm not just filling time. I took an oath. And just as if I was an assistant district attorney who was handed a case, I was expected to go to work on it.
They look at you as the guy.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. I have the full authority of the district attorney in Mecklenburg County, and I intend to use it.
Okay. A lot of people are in American jails and prisons for drug offenses. Mecklenburg County has had drug courts underfunded, they tell us, many times. They've been on this show many times. But they have drug courts. We were among the first in the country, I think, to have these drug courts, and they work.
They do. I've staffed that court, as a matter of fact, for almost a year.
And you say you've seen firsthand what happens when you treat people and restore people. Two important words. Is this approach beginning to spread, and this attitude about this is how we should handle drug offenses?
It is, and I think you're seeing it across the country. I think that many different prosecutors' offices are looking for ways to be increasingly intentional about and it's two-pronged. It's one, treating people who are sick, and treating seriously people who prey on people who are sick. So if you sell a controlled substance to someone who is suffering and who is sick, I'm going to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
If you are sick and you are fighting and struggling addiction, it's interesting. We talk about treatment court as if it's a one-time fix. It's not. Most people who go through treatment court, they probably are going to go through one or two or three times, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see the amount of effort, before I tried a single drug case, I sat in treatment court for over a year. And when you see the effort that someone has to put into trying to break their addiction, to break that cycle, it emboldens you when you have to prosecute someone who is selling and preying on that addiction.
Right. This is a new way. Why this new way of thinking about things? For years, just say no to drugs. And if you didn't say no to drugs, if you were caught with a minute amount of marijuana on your person or cocaine or something like that, they'd lock you up for a long time in some cases. Why this change in attitude on the part of law enforcement? Let's not lock them up. Let's treat them.
Well, I will say that in Mecklenburg County, I was trained to think this way. Peter Gilchrist had a hand in the creation of some of these courts. When Andrew Murray continued that and enhanced our involvement in these treatment courts, I was trained to think this way. What we're doing now is looking for new opportunities to implement this value. And I think that all of us will be having conversations throughout the criminal justice system, law enforcement, everyone, about new ways to implement this value.
Homicide in Charlotte is rising to levels we haven't seen since the 1990s. This year will be a very bad year for the murder count in Charlotte. And you said that civility has taken a dip, and that's something we must address. Are you saying that people simply have become too quick to anger and too quick to pick up a firearm to settle a petty disagreement? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly what I'm saying. I think the evidence certainly suggests that people are quick to choose ultimate conclusions to their conflicts as opposed to ones that give people a chance to come back the next day and have a discussion and argue.
And you've also said, you've talked about intervening to change the way people resolve conflicts. How does the district attorney's office do that?
We've done it before. We continue to do it. The model is what we've done in our domestic violence prosecutions. For misdemeanor domestic violence prosecutions, we know that that the scheme of domestic violence is that it graduates in scale over time. And when we've been able to intervene and get a batterer who maybe just starts with a slap, starts with a punch with a close fist, who at the most can serve 75 to 150 days in the custody of Mecklenburg County Jail, we realize we can either do that or we can put that person in a batterer's intervention program. Now, at the end of 150 days in jail, they're going to get out. And if we haven't made any attempts to change their behavior and conduct, we've done nothing. Mm-hmm. We haven't made the community any safer. However, if we've gotten them into a batterer's intervention program, we've done a lot. We can change the course of someone's behavior. So if that works for domestic violence, imagine what we can do for the way that people interact and the way that people decide to resolve conflicts elsewhere.
But I have no experience with this, but with domestic violence, it may not end in gunfire the first couple of times.
Right.
And so you can identify who potential users of firearms in a bad situation may be. But how do you do that in a situation that is not domestic violence?
Two ways. I believe that the principle is still the same, that violence tends to escalate. People don't get it in their idea the first time to pick up a gun when they're resolving their conflict. In fact, you will often see that there are people who maybe get in a fight early. Well, why aren't we intervening early and say this is not the way that we resolve conflicts in our society, in our community? Mm-hmm. And if we intervene early in our misdemeanor cases, in our district court, figuring out ways to change the way that people resolve their conflicts and solve problems. I will tell you that there's an uncomfortable percentage of people who have been charged over the course of this year for the homicide who are felons. And I do hope to devote many, many efforts to making sure that we take firearms out of the hands of felons.
How?
Well, you step up, you dedicate more time to prosecuting those cases, quite honestly. You dedicate more resources to prosecuting those cases. One of the things that we've already done in our office thus far is creating a violent crimes prosecution team. And so that we're dedicating more resources and focusing resources on robberies, on felony shootings, on firearms, felons with firearms. If you take the time to actually focus solely on those issues and prioritize them, mm-hmm. I believe that you can make a difference.
While you advocate changing the way the system treats people who could be handled in a different manner, you also want to get tougher on repeat offenders. You supervised the habitual felon prosecution team for years, and those offenders are the ones you say that pose a risk to the community, and you say that they will be dealt with harshly. It's a top priority for you. Why hasn't that always been the case, repeat offenders being dealt with harshly?
Well, I think it's also important to distinguish when we say repeat offenders. Not all of them are the same. We're talking about a repeat offender who's caught up in the cycle of addiction and it's a drug mm-hmm. case. That's a little different than the hardened criminal who actually is committing acts of violence repeatedly. I'm not going to give someone a second chance to rob someone. I'm not going to give someone a second and third chance to shoot into someone's house. I'm not going to give someone a second and third chance to sexually assault someone. And to the extent that We can use the authority of the district attorney's office and the statutes of the state of North Carolina to curb some of that crime. We'll do it.
You've created a violent crime special, violent crimes team and a special victims team, previously a crimes against persons team, prosecuted felony assaults and robberies and sex crimes, while domestic violence team prosecuted a range of crimes stemming from domestic violence. How will this switch up, this change of names and titles and groupings, how will that change things?
Again, right now it's about the dedicating prosecutors to specific areas. When we talk about the areas of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, we are talking about the crimes that are specifically personal. Mm-hmm. They're intimate. The ways that the – and really it's about the way that we handle survivors of those crimes. And we have to put them in an atmosphere where they are resources are accessible to them. We realize that many of these victims may be reticent at first to speak with us, reticent to engage in our court system, that – there can be certain things about our court system that can immediately trigger some trauma-informed response from them, and our prosecutors have to be conditioned to deal with that. That's a little bit different from when we talk about the violent crime team and the things that they deal with, the robberies, the shooting in someone's house. That's the kind of thing that can have a chilling effect on an entire block of people, an entire block of neighbors. And so those cases have to be handled in a different way. Mm-hmm. We believe that this model gives us an opportunity to do
so
just that.
When you talk about the shooting into somebody's house and how it brings down the neighborhood because it spreads fear throughout the neighborhood.
That's exactly right.
They can't, it's a random shooting and they can't live their lives.
That's right.
Do you just go after the criminals and be harder on those criminals when you find them and prosecute them?
There's that. There's also seeing whether there's connections between those crimes. I'll tell you. If you start to look at some cases, mm-hmm. and you start to see certain things in the neighborhood and you start to see certain patterns, you're able to coordinate with law enforcement, you're able to coordinate with people in that community, and you start seeing some patterns that make sense to you, and you start saying, well, not only am I dealing with this individual case, but I have to have a coordinated effort in the way that we address that the violence in that community.
Well, CMPD, I'm told, deals with about 40,000 domestic violence incidents per year. That's about 25 a day, which is alarmingly high.
And those are the ones that are reported.
Right. And you just mentioned helping these people find the way through the system. Well, we talked a little bit about this last week, this Family Justice Center that judges and I believe the district attorney's office and
right.
others want to establish. It's kind of a one-stop place, an umbrella place to go where all these services that come into play for people who are victims of domestic violence, so they don't have to go all over town to find help.
That's right.
It's all in one place. Where does that stand right now?
I will tell you that just in a couple of weeks, we've certainly gotten a lot of support for this concept. I can tell you that I've only been in office 3 weeks, and already I've visited two of these family justice centers to see what the model would look like here. The fact that they already have one in Buncombe County in Nashville, and they've already got two, or at least one in Guilford County and Greensboro, and they're thinking about building their second in High Point, mm-hmm. and Charlotte doesn't have one. Mecklenburg County doesn't have one, and I think that's a shame. What we find is that there are as many as 10 and 15 calls that a survivor of domestic violence and a survivor of sexual assault has to make, five different stops they have to make before they even get in a court. So if we can make this a little easier on survivors of these crimes, it makes for an empowered victim and an empowered survivor come court time. It also just makes for a better community.
You said that in Mecklenburg County, at least, domestic violence is at epidemic proportions. And that tells you that, and I'm going to quote you here, our community is sick. We are suffering from something. Any idea what that is?
Well, one is domestic violence. I mean, we have to make sure that we're
our
calling it
what is sick.
That's right. We need to identify the fact, and we need to call it what it is. Domestic violence is one of those things where we, unless you are drawing attention to it every single day, it's really easy to turn a blind eye to it. It's really easy to close your ears to it. Mm-hmm. But we as a community can't tolerate the fact that we have 14 intimate partner homicides pending in the city of Charlotte. 14. That's not acceptable. It hasn't been acceptable anywhere else, and it certainly shouldn't be accepted in Mecklenburg County.
We haven't talked about what significance you attach. We always talk about other people. Look, we have the first female African-American mayor. We have the first African-American district attorney in the county's history. What significance do you attach to that, if any?
Obviously, my parents are from Mobile, Alabama. They both helped to integrate our school systems in Alabama as public school educators. I take a lot of pride in being the first anything, but I also know that comes with a lot of responsibility. African Americans haven't always felt connected to our governmental institutions. They haven't always felt like there was an institution that was actually constructed for them. And that is an ongoing process in this country. It took upwards of 400 years for us to get to this place. And if I can have a hand in, you know, in making this circumstance better for not only African Americans but all people, I certainly hope I can do that.
CMPD Chief Kerr Putney talked on this program about how when he was a young man, he didn't like the police. He didn't trust them. And you had your own altercation with the police in Philadelphia when you were a high school student on a field trip. And evidently you were running to catch up with friends, and this guy kicked you in the ribs, knocked you over, and that stayed with you for a while. Do you think that incident, and just being African-American, gives you some sort of special insight into how we should change things to make the country fairer?
I think it makes me think about what sort of influence you can make on someone's perception of what authority is, and why it's why we have to be really mindful and really thoughtful about how we use authority in our criminal justice system.
Spencer Merriweather, I wish I had more time with you. I'd planned to ask you all these other questions, but unfortunately...
I'll be back.
Come back.
Sure.
You're welcome to come back. He's our new district attorney, and he has a lot of ambitious plans on the schedule in an understaffed department, which we should come back and talk about.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.